The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Today is Tuesday, so it's time for our weekly show with Dr. Peter Hammond. So let's bring him up right now. Peter, are you with us?
I'm with you, yes. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. And as Peter got into at the end of last week's show on the Wilhelm Gustloff, the worsening crisis in the Congo, it is getting no better. So Peter is going to devote the entire show today to the real story of the crisis in the Congo. So Peter, where would you like to start us off with this?
Well, there's so much to say, and it's quite a chaotic time. So what's happened is a whole lot of South African National Defence Force soldiers who are there on what our government's calling a peacekeeping mission, although they had no authority to be there. And according to the locals on the ground, the South African forces are not doing absolutely anything whatsoever to help the local people and protect them. And I had that confirmed last Thursday night. Every Thursday night, we have a Reformation Society meeting here in Cape Town, and have been for a very long time, in fact, for 20 years now. And we had a couple of Congolese people in our audience on Thursday night, and we also had a South African in the South African Air Force who served in the Congo as part of the so-called peacekeeping mission. He says it's not a peacekeeping mission. They had no orders or authority to protect anyone or to prevent atrocities. They were often just eyewitnesses to the massacres and the looting and chaos going on in the Congo. It's a completely failed state. So apparently the South African National Defence Force are in the Congo for SADC, South African Development Corporation. Now, Congo is not exactly Southern Africa. They're not part of SADC either. The SADC countries are Zambia and Zimbabwe and South Africa, Swaziland, Mozambique, and so on. I think the furthest north country is Malawi. So what SADC doing up in Central Africa in the Congo? And they're not United Nations. They're not African Union forces, who both have peacekeeping forces in the country. They're there apparently as belligerents on behalf of the Congo government against the Congo government's internal enemies, in other words, their own citizens. So it's pretty bizarre. I had confirmed to me that the South African soldiers in the Congo had no air support, had run out of ammunition, were running out of food, were struggling to survive, and were grossly undersupplied. So again, what are they doing there? So we had 14 of our soldiers, South African National Defence Force, killed in the Congo. And everyone in South Africa is saying, what are they doing there? Why are we even there? And the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, is in deep trouble with his country because the people said, you know, we didn't even know we had soldiers there. And we can't get a straight answer out of the government as to what they're doing there beyond this blatantly false claim that we're there as peacekeepers, because even the peacekeepers say we have strict orders not to interfere, not to protect any civilians. We're only allowed to shoot if we're fired upon, which is a very imbecilic rule, actually. And, you know, why do we put our soldiers in a line of fire in a very volatile, dangerous, conflict-ridden area in a failed state, and then not to support them at all? Now, we're about to have our opening of parliament in South Africa That's coming up later on next week, what's called SONA, State of the Nation Address. And we've got lots of people in Cape Town protesting, saying we shouldn't have the big military parades, which are traditional at that time, because if we can't even support our soldiers in the Congo with air support, ammunition or food, then what right do we have to squander defense budget on some kind of political parade to make the government look important? And I think they've got a valid point there. But we've got to, people want to know what's going on in the Congo and why. We need to go a bit further back in history, and it's a fascinating story. It's in fact quite extraordinary. So first of all, there's what they call the rebels, the M23 rebels, which is the movement of 23rd of April rebels. Strange name, but still. So the M23 rebels don't look like rebels. If you look at them, they look extremely well equipped. They have the most modern type of weaponry. They've got helmets which have space for fitting in these night sights and your various kinds of accessories for audio and so on. So they're the cutaway type of helmets where you can have earpieces and all of that. This is the most modern kind of uniforms. They're smart, they're well-dressed, they are disciplined, and they are well-equipped. And so they're called the rebels. And then you look and you see the army. That's the National Army of the Congo. They look like a bunch of bandit gangster rebels themselves. They are slovenly. They are in no order or discipline. Their weaponry looks like it's something sold at a bargain basement from the Cold War. It's all the old Soviet bloc AK-47s and so on. Nothing modern, and most of it looks in bad repair. And I think there's rust growing in the barrels, and in fact, the soldiers don't look like they are soldiers at all. So you've got to really look past the verbiage. The rebels don't look like rebels. They look like a real army. The army, they don't look like an army. They just look at, like a bunch of ragtag gangsters and bandits on the prowl for loot and all that. So some of the nonsense that's gone on here is you've had the UN peacekeepers sometimes going into a place and liberating an area from the rebels, and then mass rapes, looting, and so on. Dead serious. The United Nations is charged at the International Court in The Hague with 200 rapes, the largest mass rape case in history at this stage. I know there were worse, like the Red Army going into Berlin in 1945, but according to what's come before the International Court of Justice in The Hague, this is the largest rape case. And so here you've got the case where the rebels treated the people better than the UN peacekeepers. So you can see the story, the narrative that's been put out in the media is just doesn't tally with reality. I know the Congo. I've ministered in the Congo. I've had quite a few Congo people working for us in our mission. We've got a missionary in the Congo right now, a retired South African naval captain who was actually on the President Kruger, our flagship, when it sank. So he has quite a lot of experience, and he's been working on his Congo River mission for years, trying to reach the unreached people in the very heart of darkness, one of the most inaccessible parts in the world for missionary work. The Congo River Basin is a huge, massive, colossal area in the rainforest with the biggest river in the world. Now, I know the Nile is the longest river, but the Congo is the biggest in terms of volume. The river can swell to 17 miles wide in some places during the rainy season. It's a huge, massive river. And the Congo River, if you've read any of Henry Morton Stanley's books like Through the Dark Continent, then you've got some idea about the Congo. It inspired the book The Heart of Darkness. And the Congo River is a huge area with 18 million people living in it on the river or on its tributaries. So the Congo River Basin is home for 18 million people who cannot be reached by road. There's no roads to them. You can only reach them by river. There's no airport that can reach them. These are people in the rainforest, and they are only able to be reached from the river. And when you're talking about the river, you're talking about the Congo River and its tributaries, which used to be absolutely filled with crocodiles and with hippopotamuses. Sad to say there's much less of that these days, but it's the fish in the river that provides virtually all of their food supply. They have virtually no vegetables growing at all. And while some people might have access to some wild bananas, there's not much else going on there. The people living entirely from the fish in the river. So it's a very primitive existence, and these people are remote. There's very few churches, even fewer Bibles, and virtually no audio Bibles in the area. It's a major mission field. And we think that's seriously important because I'm convinced there's no political solution and no military solution to chaos. I believe it's long-term only a spiritual solution. So to go back to what's leading to this chaos in the Congo, you'll, of course, recall the genocide of 1994 in Rwanda. So in 1994, the United Nations had come in and disarmed the population as part of their peacekeeping operation. So they took guns away from people in the middle of a war zone and left the people defenseless. And once they had done that, Interahamwe mass murdering thugs of the Hutu government, the MRND government, went berserk and launched Interahamwe to hack to pieces over 800,000 Tutsi minority tribe who are mostly Protestant Christians. And perhaps you've seen the film Hotel Rwanda, which I wouldn't recommend because while it's helpful to get a bit of an idea of what happened, it doesn't tell you why it happened nor to whom it happened. And the problem with the Hotel Rwanda film is it wasn't filmed in Rwanda, and there were no Rwandese in the film. It was all Americans and South Africans pretending to be Rwandese, all filmed in South Africa. So I don't think the film was very helpful. I looked at the film and thought, you know, the roads in Rwanda don't look like that, and the homes don't look like this and that. That is not Millis Colinas Hotel. I've stayed in that hotel, and it's a multi-story hotel. In here, it's just a two-story hotel. And there's so many things that were just wrong. And you've got these people in the middle of a genocide, people being killed everywhere, no prayer, no hymn singing, no identification that these are Christian people in the middle of an anti-Christian genocide. So Hotel Rwanda, I'm afraid, was a failed film. It was maybe well-intentioned, but I'm not sure about that. I think it was a bit of a whitewash of the whole thing, trying to make it look like the United Nations actually was trying to help. A much more honest film would be Beyond the Gates, which is also distributed as Shooting Dogs, a British-made film, which was actually filmed in Rwanda with Rwandese acting in the very places where these genocides took place. And Shooting Dogs or Beyond the Gates was very helpful because it accurately portrayed what was going on and showed the United Nations treacherous behavior. At this particular venue, and I do recommend this film, the Beyond the Gates or Shooting Dogs, where the UN forces had ETO, they had this school that they were turning into a refugee camp, and they had thousands of refugees who had fled to them for safety because of the genocide. And then the UN was ordered to withdraw. But instead of being honest and telling people, we've been ordered to abandon you and leave you to your fate, and giving them at least a warning, they treacherously had them come in for supper in the big hall. And while the people were having a meal, the UN just quietly, secretively left. They drove out the gates, and the Interahamwe mass murderers were standing around there outside with their machetes ready to go in. And as the last UN vehicle drove out, they blew the whistles, rushed right in and hacked everyone to death. And that's exactly what happened. And so Shooting Dogs gets its title from when the UN were asked why they couldn't use their weapons to protect the people from the mass murders. And then they were so told, we're not allowed to interfere. But then when gunshots were heard and the missionary goes out and asks, what are you doing? I thought you weren't allowed to use your weapons. Said, no, well, we're shooting the dogs that are eating the carcasses, the bodies of the people who've been murdered. And so, I mean, the missionary just about loses his mind over this. You know, you're only allowed to shoot dogs. You cannot shoot the people who are murdering the innocent civilians here. And so that's where that title comes from. Well, there's the third film on the Rwandan genocide that's well worth seeing, and that's called Shake Hands with the Devil. And Shake Hands with the Devil, based on the book written by General Romeo Dallaire. He is the Canadian general in charge of the UN forces, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, so-called, in Rwanda. And he documents in his book and his film, and I've read the book and seen the film, and he oversaw the making of the film, which was also filmed in Rwanda, with Rwandese acting at the very sites where these things took place. And so it's very authentic. And General Romeo Dallaire admits they knew about the genocide. They had prior warning long before. He warned the Secretary General of the United Nations. He, I think, was Boutros-Ghali. He warned Kofi Annan, who was head of the Security Council. Warren Christopher, the American Secretary of State, was warned, as was Madeleine, not that bright at the UN ambassador. And then, of course, Bill Clinton's government were fully informed. So all ahead of time. And at one point, General Dallaire planned to raid the warehouse where there were 1 million Chinese machetes or pangas waiting to be distributed into Harambe to kill the Tutsi Christians. And so he thought his job as a peacekeeper empowered him to go and confiscate these machetes. And he knew what they were planned for. He even knew of the lists of people who were going to kill and all that sort of thing. But then Kofi Annan of the Security Council ordered him not to intervene. And he found that bizarre. In fact, General Dallaire later said, it's the greatest regret in his life that he obeyed orders and did not interfere and didn't intervene and preempt the genocide. He said he should have spent the rest of his life in prison if he'd gone against orders, but at least he would have had a clear conscience. And he makes it clear in his book, we knew about the genocide, we could have stopped the genocide, we could have done a lot more to save lives, and this is a complete and utter disgrace. In fact, his title was the Shake Hands with the Devil, and then he put as a subtitle, The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. Not the failure of the United Nations, the failure of humanity. Because General Dallaire actually was a real believer. He believed in the United Nations. He trusted the United Nations. He thought he was there to do good. He actually thought he was there to save lives, which, of course, he was not. But he came out of it shattered because of his he was disillusioned because he actually expected something good out of the UN. And he saw how they were accessories to the mass murder that took place there. And it got so bad that the United Nations literally abandoned people. There were people came to the gates into Harambe mass murders with lists of Tutsi Christians they wanted. At first it was the journalists, and then it was some of the politicians and social activists to get rid of. And then later it was teachers, pastors, and the UN went to the trouble of searching through the camp, bringing out these people who were hacked to death within sight of the UN gates by the Inter-Harambe mass murderers, who came back the next day with another list. And can you imagine, the UN continued to hand people over to the Inter-Harambe and in the end abandoned the refugees who had fled to them for safety. So it was about 10 years after the genocide that Kofi Annan was finally prevailed upon to give some kind of vague apology. And his words were to the Rwandese people, the world failed you. Not I failed you, not the United Nations failed you, the world failed you. How's that for taking personal responsibility? Well, the French were not uninvolved. The French government was helping the Inter-Harambe mass murdering thugs who were butchering the people by the hundreds of thousands. And when the Rwandese Tutsi rose up to overthrow this mass murdering genocidal government with the help of the Ugandan government, French government propelled into action. And it was documented by General Romeo Dallaire that the French government was flying in empty planes. Now, here he was pleading for ammunition, pleading for medical care, pleading for food for the refugees he's trying to protect, and he is getting nothing. And the French government could fly in empty planes where they could have brought in some supplies for them, and then flying out many of the Inter-Harambe mass murdering thugs, the genocidal architects and their families, and sometimes their loot and things that they'd stolen from people who'd been murdered, and flying them back to France, Canada, and other places in the French-speaking world where they could escape justice. And then the French launched Operation Turquoise, and Operation Turquoise was the French Foreign Legion paratroopers came in to Rwanda and created a cordon sanitaire, a safe zone to which Interahamwe mass murderers could flee, and the French protected them. And behind a cordon of French paratroopers and Foreign Legion, they withdrew into Zaire, what today is the Congo. And so many of the people responsible for the mass murdering genocide in Rwanda, Hutu mass murderers, fled into the Congo and Zaire. And that's the backdrop to what's going on now. So the M23 is a guerrilla group, so-called, even though they look like a regular army, supplied and supported by the Ugandan government and the Rwandan government to help keep the Interahamwe mass murderers who were responsible for the genocide from getting established and launching further terrorist attacks into Rwanda. So to prevent a reoccurrence of the genocide of 1994 in Rwanda, Rwanda has been supporting these rebel groups within the Congo in order to harass and harangue and destabilize, disperse the threat to Rwanda of people who've committed mass murder before and are doubtless planning to do so again. So that's the backstory to what's going on here. So the Great Lakes War that took place in the 1990s killed millions of people. I've heard some people say it could have been up to 9 to 10 million, which is possible. I've heard low figures like 3 to 6 million, but that's too low. It's likely to be a lot more. And again, we had a Congolese at our meeting last Thursday saying he believes that more than 16 million Congolese have been killed in the Congo since independence in 1960. So the story to go further back, why we're in such a mess today and why there's so much chaos going on in the Congo, is that in 1960, the United States government of Eisenhower, he put pressure on Belgium to get out of the Congo. It was a high American foreign policy goal to get Europe out of Africa after the Second World War. And I think it was documented that the price of American lend-lease and help to Britain and France was that the Allies would evacuate out of Africa. And this is a key part of the Cold War. So 1960, at the height of the Cold War, with the Soviets and the Red Chinese destabilizing in Africa, sponsoring Marxist revolutionary terrorist groups, murdering farmers, butchering whites, killing ministers and missionaries, raping nuns. I mean, all of this is going on. And the United States government puts such pressure that Belgium just flees. And Belgium warned it's going to be chaos. The Congo is not ready for independence. And indeed, events since proved that the Belgians were totally right. And yet, bullied by the Americans, they pulled out. And of course, nature abhors a vacuum. What poured into Africa in the absence of the Europeans who had been developing it? Now, the Europeans had come to Africa for many reasons. Initially, it was to stop the slave trade. So if you start with North Africa, North Africa was the base of the Barbary pirates who were raiding Europe for centuries, stealing people and making them slaves in North Africa. So over 1.1 million Europeans were kidnapped between 1500 and 1800 from southern Europe, and some of them from as far afield as Iceland and Cornwall and Ireland. Barbary pirates were kidnapping white Europeans, Christians, who were forced to be slaves in North Africa. And virtually every building of substance, every harbor, every fortification and palace in North Africa was built by European slaves kidnapped by North African pirates and slave raiders. I mean, that's just another story. But so first, Italy starting to take places like Libya, and France taking places such as Algeria and Tunisia and Morocco to stop the slave traders from raiding their southern ports. And then later they had to consolidate, and that's where North Africa came under European control. But then there was the other kind of slave trades, and so Britain and other powers in Europe took different parts of Africa to eradicate the slave trade and to develop Africa. And to a large extent, they did so. They built who knows how many hundreds of thousands of kilometers of roads and railways, and brought electricity in, and built dams and hospitals and schools and law courts. And it was a tremendous task to turn savage places like the Congo into civilization. And you can get a bit of a feel of it from Henry Morton Stanley's reports on what the Congo was like before the European missionaries came in, cannibalism was rife, and intertribal slavery was normal. The Arab slave trade was busy in the Congo too. Congo was filled with cannibalism, heads on stakes, skulls decorating the fences around villages, human bones scattered around fireplaces. It was a hideous situation, and it's a tremendous tribute to people like Henry Morton Stanley, who brought civilization to Congo and ended the intertribal genocide, and missionaries like C.T. Studd, who came to the Congo and made a tremendous impact. One of the books I remember reading of the daughter of C.T. Studd, Edith, and in her book, Reluctant Missionary, described how her father did the first baptism in the crocodile-infested rivers with a revolver in his right hand as he baptized with his left, as he was firing at the crocodiles to keep them away, because one crocodile can ruin a baptism. And tremendous insights on what it was like bringing civilization to countries like Rhodesia and the Congo and so on. And the biggest battle was to end the slave trade and to chase out the slave raiders and establish rule of law and civilization in Africa. And the missionaries succeeded, and it's a tremendous tribute to those great pioneers who brought civilization into the savage heart of Central Africa. And so after 60 years of civilization in the Congo, the Americans bullied the Belgians to get out. And the Belgians left precipitously, and chaos just rocked the country in its wake. And we're talking about massacres, human sacrifices. It got so bad, to give you a feel of what's the very area we're talking about right now. And we've got a missionary right in that area in eastern Congo. There was a group called the Simbas. And the Simbas were a Marxist, or I should say a Maoist, Red Chinese-backed communist terrorist group. And the Simbas literally took thousands of hostages. All the whites in the area were kidnapped and made into hostages. And they moved them into Stanleyville, which Stanleyville is today called Kisangani, the very place where our missionary is based right now, the headwaters of the Nile River, the furthest navigatable point up in the Congo River. And this is in the Eastern Highlands. So in Stanleyville, there were thousands of white European civilians and missionaries, medical people and so on, kept as hostages. And the Simbas were sacrificing a couple every day. And they had a big altar set up in the center of town with a massive picture portrait of Patrice Lumumba, who is the communist dictator, the first so-called president of the Congo, which was a failed state anyway. But Patrice Lumumba was such a communist that the Soviets established a terrorist training school in Moscow called the Patrice Lumumba University. And I've met people who trained at Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow, some of whom came to Christ later and worked for our mission. But here they were telling us how in Stanleyville, there was this regular daily sacrifice of human beings, of European missionaries and other civilians, medical people and so on, in front of this portrait of Patrice Lumumba, and literally ripping out their beating hearts. And the mayor of Stanleyville, who is a big black man, they forced him to stand naked in the center of town while they ripped out his liver and ate his beating liver in the center of town in front of people while he was still alive, as he was dying, seeing a person eating his liver in front of his eyes. So that's the kind of savagery that was going on there. Now, under the circumstances, the Belgians had to send back in their paratroopers to rescue their citizens who were literally under the knife and about to be sacrificed. But the Belgian paratroopers were a bit late, and the French Foreign Legion were very, very, very late. They didn't get there in time to rescue their people, and there were many French citizens and Belgian citizens in the Congo about to be massacred in the wake of having abandoned this country to savagery. And so, interesting fact of history is that a South African and Rhodesian group of mercenaries, so-called Five Commander, the famous Wild Geese, under the command of Colonel Mike Hoare. Maybe some of our listeners have seen the film with Richard Burton and Richard Harris in it, and Roger Moore, of the Wild Geese. Well, that was meant to be based in the Congo, and it was it was directly inspired by the activities of Colonel Mike Hall, who was on set as the special advisor, and the activities of the Wild Geese. So that is a bit of a background. Somebody might be interested to see that to get a bit of a feel of what we're talking about. And so the Wild Geese, or Five Commando, these mercenaries, mostly from South Africa and from Rhodesia, are swept into town in their jeeps, and they rescued 2,000 white hostages, missionaries and civilians, medical people and so on, nuns, Catholic priests and all that sort of thing. 2,000 people rescued, not just in Stanleyville, but also from many of the different pockets of like mission stations and schools in the surrounding areas. And I know missionaries get a bad name, but that must have been their finest hour when they did what the European forces failed to do. They rescued thousands of civilians from out of the jaws of the lion. And there's a book, one of the first Christian books I ever read as a new Christian, Out of the Jaws of the Lion, inspired from the passage in Hebrews 11, speaking about those who were delivered from the jaws of the lion. And it's a story of many of those survivors who had the mercenaries to thank for being rescued from the Simbas. Simba is a Swahili name for lion. And so these Maoist terrorists were calling themselves the Lions. And so the book was From the Jaws of the Lion. And that is a series of fascinating testimonies, first-hand testimonies of people who were living under the fear of being sacrificed to this new pagan god on a daily basis and witnessed unspeakable savagery, and were able to survive thanks to these mercenaries who swept in and did the thankless task of rescuing these people who'd been abandoned by their governments in Europe. Well, that's the backdrop. So Congo is a failed state. The Congo is such a failed state, it's a matter of bring your own infrastructure. When our missionaries go to the Congo, we need to take our own generators, we need to take our own water purification systems. You cannot depend on the government for anything. No plumbing, no electricity, and certainly no protection. The government in the Congo is not able to protect its people, not able to serve its people. Forget about schools and justice. They can't even provide them with water and electricity. They can't even maintain the roads. It takes months to travel what you could have done in a matter of hours back in the 60s with the roads that the Belgians had built. So absolutely staggering what's going on there. And it's a very difficult terrain, such as the people now that we're trying to reach in the Congo River area can only be reached by boat. There's no way of reaching them by any roads. There are no roads in those areas. The roads that were built have all been destroyed, completely and utterly unworkable. You can't believe what a mess the place is in. Because in the past, they had railways. And all the railways have fallen apart. They're not working anymore. So now the people need to truck everything in these big 18-wheeler pentatonicons, which the roads were not built to sustain such heavy traffic. So with the railways deteriorating, next thing is the roads deteriorate very, very fast. And having driven on those roads, it's hard for you to believe how messed up so many of those roads can be because of these heavy delivery vehicles trying to do the job of what a railway would do in a civilized country. And the end result is the people are isolated and they're living in abject poverty. Disease is so bad. Our missionary to Congo, just in the last few months, he got there in September, he said typhoid, dysentery, malaria twice. And I mean, that's just normal in those areas. You cannot go very long without contracting something. And there's all kinds, you know, yellow fever, you name it. There's all kinds of bizarre hepatitis and so on. That's normal out there. But typhoid, I mean, that's how bad it is. So you're in a situation now where the South African government is exchanging a war of words with the Rwandan government because they believe Rwanda is supporting the M23 so-called rebels who took over South African military base. And to look at the pictures of the base, it looks like a squatter camp. It's an absolute wreck. And the tents are falling apart and blowing away. And the soldiers were literally starving. And they actually ran out of ammunition, which is unbelievable that you can put your forces in the area and not even supply them with enough food or ammunition. That's how bad that situation is. But the crisis in the Congo right now is a direct result of the Eisenhower policy of kicking Europeans out of Africa and turning Africa into the playground and battleground of the superpowers in the Cold War. And the Congo was for a long time under one of the Western allies, clients. Mobutu Sese Seko, who is a kleptomaniac of note, he at one time was interviewed by a brave journalist and said, "How is it that you have the fourth poorest country in the world and you're the fifth richest man in the world?" And he interjected and said, "No, I'm the fourth richest man in the world," which kind of proves the point. His personal wealth was about equivalent to the national debt of his country, which can't be coincidental. So you've got these kleptomaniacs going berserk there, but the situation's worse. There are 12 countries with armies in the Congo. It's such a failed state. It reminds you of what China was like at the turn of the previous century, which led to the Boxer Rebellion, where you had every kind of embassy and army rampaging around China because China was a failed state. And that's why you had the Russians and the Japanese, and you had the Italians and the French and the Germans and the British and the Americans and everyone else had armies inside China, because China was a failed state at the turn of the 18th and the 19th centuries. I should say turn of the 19th and the 20th century. And so now in the Congo, you've got the Angolan army, the Namibian army, the Zimbabwe army, Mozambique army. You've got the Sudan army, Central African Republic. You have Tanzania, Congo Brazzaville, Central African Republic, and even Uganda and Rwandan defense forces inside the Congo. Although Rwanda and Uganda are there primarily to preemptively stop terrorists attacking their own country from the Congo, and to deal with these Interahamwe mass murderers who escaped justice because of Operation Turquoise and the French rescuing them. Interesting, France is a signatory to the Anti-Genocide Treaty, but that doesn't stop them from protecting actual genocidal lunatics in France. So as I documented in my book, Holocaust in Rwanda, when people asked the French foreign minister, "What is France doing in Rwanda?" And his answer famously was, "We are holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa." Translation, the Hutu mass murderers speak French, so we're going to protect them. The Rwandese Patriotic Front, who are fighting for the freedom of the victims of the genocide, they speak English because they've had to flee out of Rwanda, which used to be French-speaking. And the history, if you go back far enough, is Rwanda and Burundi used to be part of German East Africa, or Tanganyika. Used to be part of Tanganyika, what today is Tanzania. But at the end of the First World War, at the Treaty of Versailles, which has to be the worst treaty in the history of the world, the treaty that guaranteed the Second World War, the Treaty of Versailles gave part of German East Africa to Belgium, and so they gave Rwanda and Burundi to Belgium, whereas the rest of Tanganyika was taken over by the British. And so that's why the people in Rwanda spoke French. So they were initially civilized by the Germans, and then they were taken over by the Belgians. And the Belgians pretty much favored the Tutsi, who were the leaders, and that was resented. And so at independence, when Belgium abandoned them, massacres of Tutsi Protestants was the order of the day by the new government, if you can use the word government, but I'm using a small G with italics around it. And you can see this is the backdrop to what's going on now. Europe came in and civilized these countries and evangelized these countries, betrayed these countries and fled because the Americans were bullying them. And in came the Red Chinese and the Soviets, who armed the revolutionaries and radicalized the people. And the result was tremendous massacres of whites. And then later, after the whites had mostly fled, they turned on the Protestant Tutsi in Rwanda. And what you're seeing in the Congo is tribalism. There's a lot of witchcraft involved in it as well. But Marxism is the key element in the backdrop. And you can definitely see also the bad influences of France. The French government has come in and messed around a lot. So they even armed and trained and supported genocidal mass murderers in Rwanda just because they spoke French, and justified it because the people that were being targeted preferred to speak English, mainly because they had to flee to Uganda and Tanganyika for refuge when they were being massacred in French-speaking Rwanda. And so after the Rwandese Patriotic Front, the Tutsi regained the country and chased the genocidal lunatics into the Congo, the Rwandan government decided from referendum to abandon French and to make English the national language of Rwanda. So that just, again, puts another interesting spin on it. The people in the Congo speak French, the people in Uganda and Rwanda speak English, and this is, to some degree, you could see there's a language side to how these battles are lining up. And then in comes South Africa and Malawi and a whole lot of other countries that have got nothing to do with this, with so-called peacekeeping forces, but they're supporting one side in the ongoing struggles, and as a result have found themselves in conflict with the people who are trying to protect themselves from a repeat of the massacres, the genocide of 1994. So I'm sure Andrew must have some more questions or comments on this, but that's the backdrop behind what's going on. I'm absolutely convinced there's no political or military situation to this complicated, catastrophic shambles of a mess, which is some of the residue of the Cold War and US foreign policy and the meddling of the Soviets and particularly right now the Red Chinese. But this is why we think it's so important and strategic for missionaries to be going in. I don't believe we should be sending in the Marines. I believe we should be sending in the missionaries. David was a conqueror. He killed Goliath, which is a great achievement. But our Lord Jesus Christ is more than a conqueror. He took Saul, the persecutor of the church, and turned him into Paul, the missionary and apostle of the church. And so we believe the solution ultimately is evangelism, discipleship, transform terrorists into evangelists, evangelize our enemies. Guerrillas need the gospel, and we need to get redemption for the revolutionaries. And the goal is by evangelizing these war-torn areas, bombarding them with Bibles instead of bombs, that we can turn the situation around and have a long-term solution in the future by building up Christian communities in the Congo River Basin, what used to be called the Heart of Darkness. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Certainly. I'll just mute my Peter for the moment because, as you know, I always get feedback. It just needs to catch up. I'll see that going away. It's going away now. Okay, so, you started off by talking about the 14 South African Defence Force members that have been killed in the Congo. And obviously you went into the history. So essentially, I see where you're coming from about evangelism, missionary work, what have you, is the only way that you're going to overcome this situation. What do you think, if you were to sum up in one or two sentences, who is behind this conflict and what are they hoping to achieve?
I would say Red China is the primary external involvement, but they're using a lot of different African armies and they're after the raw materials. The Congo is a very potentially rich country. It should be one of the richest countries in the world. And that was the anticipation of people like Henry Morton Stanley. They've got everything. Diamonds, manganese, cobalt, uranium, so many rich minerals and a rainforest, not to mention the hydroelectric potential. The Congo River could provide enough electricity for every home, every industry in all of Africa. Not only now, but for the foreseeable future. If they fully utilized, harnessed the tremendous hydroelectric power potential of the Congo River. So there's no reason for the Congo to be a basket case failed state. It should be a rich country. It's because of corporations, countries like Red China and kleptomaniac presidents who have looted this country into oblivion. You can't even move a few kilometers without going through roadblocks with their bribe-hungry so-called policemen and officials. So minerals is, I think, at the heart of it. And this is Red China seeking to rape the Congo. And there's a few groups trying to protect themselves. But in the main, I think this is leftover from the Cold War. But at the moment, I think the only superpower still involved is Red China.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, that is interesting. And of course, that's something that we need to really focus on as to what the purpose is for this, because again, we've seen time and time again that these where minerals etc. are involved, there's very little willingness to stop their plundering, despite how, doesn't matter how many people get killed, so long as they get rich, whoever are the people behind it. And the quick question, I don't want to sort of divert the topic, but I heard some years ago someone who said that they dealt in they dealt in diamonds, they dealt in different sort of jewellery and precious stones and things like that. And they would never buy a diamond themselves because they said on a radio show that the price of diamonds is monopolised and it's kept artificially high. And in reality, if the price reflected the supply, you could actually buy a diamond for the same amount of money as a bunch of red roses. But what are your thoughts on that? Is there any truth to that?
There is some truth to it. I think that's a slight exaggeration, but the person's generally correct. There are vast amounts of uncut diamonds in vaults underneath London. Vast, vast, vast amounts. We're talking about tons. And London is in many ways the central control of the diamond industry these days. And, you know, we can thank Cecil John Rhodes initially for consolidating the diamond mines, because at one point there were so many people harvesting diamonds and so many diamonds available that the prices were quite low. And you wouldn't have had to fork out 3 months' wages to buy a diamond ring to get an engagement ring for your beloved. And so they saw a monopoly was the only way for the future. There were so more diamonds available than anyone had ever imagined when it got to the Kimberley diamond mines in South Africa. And there's so many other diamond mines I've discovered since, like the Mereng diamond fields of Zimbabwe, which China's looting, and the many private diamond mines in the Congo right now. So, yes, my youngest daughter just got engaged on Sunday, and I saw that her fiancé used the new diamonds they're making in a laboratory, so to avoid the conflict diamonds, the blood diamonds, so-called. And if someone wants to know what's going on with blood diamonds, there's a film out called Blood Diamonds, which is surprisingly accurate. It depicts a Rhodesian soldier who had served in 3-2 Battalion, and the dynamics of what goes on in the blood diamond industry in Africa. And I think people need to understand what's going on, because I don't see what a blood diamond has to do with love. And I understand the concept that an expensive ring indicates that you've got the ability to earn and to provide, and that you're serious, and that this indicates something that means this isn't just a date, you're committed for a long time. It took you months to be able to of salary to afford a diamond ring. So I can see some of the purpose behind it, but this has gone too far now. And these evil companies that are looting areas, and these criminals like the people up in Liberia and Sierra Leone who have exploited the blood diamond industry. And so, yes, I understand now why people are getting synthetic-made diamonds made in laboratory to avoid being part of this disgusting industry of blood diamonds. And so, yes, there is something true to that, that diamonds don't need to be anything near as expensive as they actually are. It's an artificially created shortage made by getting most of the uncut diamonds are dumped into vaults beneath London, and they've created an artificially shortage of the materials. And so they can charge almost anything, and people are forced to buy at unrealistically high prices. So that much is true. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, so is there any other... obviously, please let the audience know where they can contact you and how they can find your work, your website, etc. Also, folks, I just want to point out Peter has a Give Send Go page, and that is the link to that is in the post for this show. So please keep Peter in mind for this. As you heard, he has a missionary over in the Congo at the moment, so he has someone on the ground. He's fully invested in this conflict and is actively trying to do something to help the people who are suffering as a result. So Peter, any closing statement, and then please let the audience know how they can contact you and where they can find your work.
Yes, thank you so much, Andrew. I don't know if you've read the book The Fearful Master, A Second Look at the United Nations by G. Edward Griffin, but it's one of the best books I've ever read on the UN. And it comes from the quote, it basically analyzes the United Nations in the Congo and what a hideous job it did. And the title, The Fearful Master, comes from a great quote from General George Washington. General George Washington, the first president of the United Nations, of the United States, said that government is not reason, government is force. And like a fire, it makes a dangerous servant and a fearful master. So fires can be very helpful for heating food, and there's a lot of warming the home and so on. But if you let the fire get out of its fireplace, if the fire reaches your curtains, which are notoriously flammable, or your carpet, or your furnishings, the whole house can be gone. And so government is like a fire. It is not reasonable, it's force. It's a dangerous servant, and it's a fearful master. And I think you can say that about technology in general, but and governments in general, but the point of G. Edward Griffith in his book, The Fearful Master, is that the United Nations is not just like any normal government, a dangerous servant and a fearful master, but the most fearful master of all is an international government. And we've seen this. The United Nations can go into a bad situation and make it much, 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 much worse. I've seen this in Rwanda. I've seen this in Sudan. I've seen this in Angola, Namibia. And, of course, now we see it in the Congo. The Congo, it may surprise all of our listeners to know, has the largest United Nations peacekeeping force in the world, the most failed state in the greatest chaotic shambles, one of the most violent places on earth right now, has the most UN peacekeepers. Now, doesn't it tell you something's wrong here? And the people on the ground tell us they're more afraid of the UN than they are afraid of the rebels. The rebels treat them better and are more disciplined than the UN. In come the United Nations forces, and they have done the largest mass rape of modern history in the Congo, and that's United Nations peacekeepers. And the main contribution of the UN to the Congo, when I asked the local people, well, what are they contributing to the country? And the answer was, with a straight face, syphilis, HIV. I mean, dead serious. That's the main contribution of the United Nations peacekeeping force to Rwanda, is rape and infecting the people with venereal diseases. So, you know, just think of that, that this is where our tax money is going. And I applaud Donald Trump for pulling America out of the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization was the first UN group launched after the launching of the United Nations itself. I think the next step is to get the United States out of the United Nations totally and to stop funding this evil organization. I see there's a lot of discussion about U.S. aid needing to be dismantled, that it's not an apple with a worm in it. It's a bowl full of worms. There is no apple. And I would say if that's true for USAID, it's even more true for the United Nations. I've seen the United Nations on the ground in places like Sudan, and no, the United Nations is not the solution. They are the problem. And part of the issue here is that they're answerable to no one. They are a law unto themselves. UN peacekeepers are not subject to the law of the country in which they're interfering, and they're not subject to the law of the country from where they came. They are supernatural, supernational. They are transnational. They are representing the United Nations, which considers itself above every other country's laws. So it's bad enough having soldiers running around in the country given martial law. They can get very out of control if you're not careful. But United Nations forces have a terrible track record of being given more authority than they know what to do with, and they abuse it. You know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So I've documented that in my books, like Frontline Behind Enemy Lines for Christ and Faith on the Fire in Sudan, Holocaust in Rwanda, in the Killing Fields of Mozambique. So my books document a lot of the atrocities of the UN and the New World Order, and it's important for us to know who we're dealing with. I'm very glad to hear that these people might be getting defunded by the United States. I think it's time that Europe also defunds these creeps. What they've done in the name of peace and justice is just beyond criminal. It's absolutely wicked. The United Nations grew out of the so-called allies of the Second World War. And just remember all the atrocities committed by those who could incinerate cities, betray whole nations in Eastern Europe through the Yalta Agreement into the hands of the savage Red Army and the Soviet Union, Operation Keelhaul, the Katyn Forest Massacre. I mean, this is the roots of the United Nations. And I look at the UN today and I say, It's the biggest group of gangsters, unelected dictators, mass murderers, human traffickers, cocaine-sniffing drug addicts in the world. The United Nations is neither united nor are they nations. They are just a bunch of gangsters with flags. And it's time for all civilized people and nations to pull out and to disinvest from and stop funding this disgusting international group. And they're causing chaos throughout the world. Africa would be so much better off. The Congo would be particularly better off if we could end the United Nations and get the United Nations out. Not just get the United States out of the United Nations, get the United Nations out of the Congo and all these other countries that are suffering. Just supporting a few missionaries will do infinitely more good than supporting UN troops in any of these countries. And we are struggling in our mission to maintain daily operations. We are continually in the red. We are short of funds. We've got our missionary in the field lacking support, lacking even a outboard motor for his. He's just pleading for a 15 horsepower Yamaha outboard motor for his dugout canoe to be able to get around to deliver the Bibles. And I'm thinking a dugout canoe is not good enough. He needs a real boat. But the cost of everything is huge. We need to truck things in. It's vital that our missionary on the ground has a trustworthy means of communication, and cell phones are not adequate in most of those places. We need a satellite phone like I needed when I was in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. Some places are just out of other kind of contact, and he needs a good motor. He needs a good boat. We need lots of Bibles. We need co-workers. Where are all the youngsters willing to do something dangerous for the Lord and the Lord's work? That people are willing to volunteer to work for the United Nations is understandable. They get phenomenal salaries and a huge amount of money. But where are the Christians willing to go in these countries as missionaries? And here we've got a missionary in his late 60s. He's a retired naval officer, and he's doing work that people in their 20s should be doing. We need more young people, more volunteers. We are short of staff. We're short of missionaries. The harvest is very large. The workers are all too few. And so we urge you to think of a positive, constructive support for these conflict areas like the Congo, instead of wasting money on another UN or government initiative or US aid and these useless organizations. Let's support real people on the ground doing real work. So if you visit our mission website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org, frontlinemissionsa.org. So our email is, my email is peter@frontline.org.za. Our website is www.frontlinemissionsa.org. And that SA is short for South Africa. So frontlinemissionsa.org. And you'll see we've got donate buttons with details on Congo River Mission and Bibles for Africa and Literature for Africa and all the other good projects we're dealing with, training chaplains and so on. We really urgently need help and we need support. And we'd really appreciate your encouragement. So please get in touch with us. And if there's some listener who is adventurous and wants to go into the Congo, one of the most difficult mission fields on earth, do contact us. We need people willing to go and work alongside Johan, help him in this magnificent Congo River mission. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Peter. Okay, so we'll wrap the show up for today. I want to thank Peter again so much for joining us today on a show entitled The Real Story of the Crisis in the Congo. I want to thank all of you for listening. Peter and I will be back with you at the same time next Tuesday. I'll be back with you all tomorrow. And until then, folks, have a wonderful day and bye for now.